This is Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music Documentaries. Telling the stories in music that matter.
I'm Dave Grohl with the John Bonham Story.
From Kraftwerk to the Sex Pistols.
Everything that precedes it is rubbish. We only might know three chords, but we have one fabulous word, and that's anarchy.
Find out more at the Six Music website. Now, Six Music Documentaries present Master Tapes.
Welcome to Master Tapes and to Corinne Bailey-Ray playing live for our audience here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. In this edition, we'll be discussing Corinne's 2010 album, The Sea, which, after the huge commercial success of her debut record, explored deeper musical territory with songs of love and loss, including Love's On Its Way and Are You Here?
Here's a real life wire. Here's the best of his kind. Wait to see the wings
Corinne Bailey-Ray, welcome to Master Tapes.
Thank you.
The Sea, the album we're talking about today, is a beautiful and at times heartbreaking record about love and resilience and hope, and is clearly a very personal album. And we'll hear about that in the programme. But it marked a dramatic change musically from the debut record. And that was a record which saw you become a big star here and in the States. It sold 4 million copies and you were nominated for Grammy Awards and Brit Awards, and it went straight to number one in the UK. When did you start thinking about the follow-up? Was there immediate pressure from the record company? We've got to capitalise on this. We've got to get another record out there straight away.
You know, I think they've been quite sound, actually, EMI. I've always gotten pretty well with them. So there was never a sense of like, right, what's the next record? If anything, with that album, it was more like, hey, there's some more countries you can tour on, and what about doing this and what about doing this? And after about 18 months stroke 2 years of touring that album, I was the one who thought, actually, I want to go home. I want to do something new. You know, a lot of those songs were reasonably old to me, so I just wanted to make up some more songs, and I wanted to make up some songs that were different to the songs on the album. So I'd spent most of the album writing with other people, which I felt I'd learned loads from. But I really wanted to just see what would happen if it was just me in a room on my own, opening up my mind or whatever and just playing guitar. That's what I really wanted to do with The Sea. And I did get back and think, oh, there's no way I'm going to start writing it. I want a massive holiday and I want to relax. And then my husband, it was crazy because we were touring together and then he stopped touring with me. Then he went on tour with Mark Ronson, literally like the week before I finished my 2 year tour with my first album. So I was just like, oh, okay. So then I was at home on my own. So I probably just started writing songs just because I was bored and I was just on my own.
And the title track of The Sea, that was one of the first songs that you wrote for the album, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I wrote the song about a family story. It's about my mum's dad, my granddad, who had died when she was young in this accident at sea. I hadn't asked any more questions than that. I'd always just been brought up with this, you know, he died in this accident and she was quite young. At this particular time when I was writing the story, I just found out this one piece of information about my aunt, who I really love. I just found out that she had been there when this happened.
On the beach?
Yeah, exactly. Sort of seen this happen and been powerless to do anything about it, and this massive life transformation, you know, someone's there, then someone's not there, and it's this irreversible thing. So the song really was about things that happen to you in your life and to what extent they shape you, especially when things happen when you're young, you know, to what extent you can ever break out of that shape and change your life and how things stay with you and how things influence you going forward. And just started writing that song about that.
Had they talked, you know, your mum or your auntie, had they talked about the accident, or were you just trying to imagine yourself into that situation try and make sense of it for yourself?
I think it was just really a sort of starting point. And I think I definitely probably could have been more sensitive around that area. At that time, I had experienced no loss. So to me, this was something that happened a long time ago. Mm. But I think grief, for me, has really showed me like how time is not a linear thing. So it's not like this happens in the past and then you've got now and you've got the future. It's like they all sort of coexist, I think. But yeah, they hadn't really talked to me that much about it. I guess I sort of started to imagine this scenario. I think part of the song was about me and part of the song was about I sort of imagining what it was. Her. Yeah.
And the very first line of the song itself, and you say, "I never knew you were standing on the shore."
Yeah.
It explains everything.
Yeah.
And that is a very personal thing, isn't it? That you're almost talking to your aunt or to your mum and to the people who were there.
It's true. And songwriting's so weird because I've said things in that song that I wouldn't even say in real life to the person. And yeah, so I think a lot about that. I think, how wise is that to do, or how sensible is that to do? I think when you're songwriting, you think it's very true, but at the same time, it's definitely a medium. It's not a mask, but it's somehow a shield. I don't know, it sort of protects you. So there's things I wrote about in that song, and then when they really got analysed, I thought, gosh, I've said so much.
Have you had a conversation with your aunt about that song?
I've talked to my whole family. It's so weird when your family, they just know you as you, and then you've got all these ideas, and they would never normally come out. You'd never normally sit and invite your family around and be like, I'm going to read you my diary and I want to know what you all think. You would never do that. But then suddenly you've written songs that are really personal and they're like, oh, I didn't know you felt like that. I didn't know you thought like that. And sometimes you have to say, well, I don't. This is just my imagination.
So you start off with a set of lyrics for that song, I presume. You'd written down that as a scenario. Or does it start working its way up with the music? Because the musical setting is very beautiful. There's a dreamlike quality
Thank
to
you.
That song. How technically would the words and the music have
I feel
come
like
together.
Whenever I write, it's always just like a giant mess. Most of the time, if I'm writing songs, I'll just be playing like this and I'll just be thinking, you know, what is that sort of, what is that saying? I'll play different chords and then I'll just like sing, you know, sing a melody over. And sometimes I'll be just singing oohs and ahs or nonsense. A lot of time I just sing a made-up language or something. And then sometimes out of the made-up language, I'll just get one line and then I'll think, oh, what sort of, where did that come from? And then I feel like it's sort of my job to chase that down, you know, like, oh, there's, so that line, you know, I never knew that you were standing on the shore. I think, now what am I going to say? What is this song about? What's it telling me? So it is a sort of strange process. You know, I'm not like a classically trained musician or something. Like you said earlier, when I was trying to remember that riff, it's E, and I'm thinking, oh, I don't know what that is, you know? I know what this string is, E, but I don't know exactly what all the rest of the ones are.
Do you not? You play the guitar and you play it very beautifully, but you don't actually know the notes.
I only know
notes.
My own songs.
Right,
so if you were like, play Yellow Submarine, I can't play Yellow Submarine. I'm quite lazy, but when I get my guitar, I just want to try and make things up. So
and you feel your way into the songs then?
Yeah, I just find shapes, you know, so like if I was doing it now, I'd be like, oh, okay, that's nice. But then I'd be like, actually, I do like that. So, yes, I just look at shapes and then I think, all right, well, that guy's not going to work. So then I just mute that. Or I don't know. I love guitar because it's just such a weird instrument. It's not like a piano where it's all set out logically and it's low to high and you've got to get those triads right. The guitar's just, to me, it's just loads of different shapes. I remember an episode of Friends where Phoebe was teaching one of them to play guitar and she was saying, right, this one's called the claw. And they're like, sure, that's not what it is. And she just had these shapes, but I was watching it thinking, yeah, I sort of think of that as like, this is the triangle, this is like four in a row.
You still think whatever. Of them like that, do you?
Well, yeah, because partly I think now that I've gone down that route, I feel like I don't want to lose the magic of it. Some of my friends are more musical and they'll be like, oh, that's just a 2-5-1 with an inversion of so and so, and I'm like, don't ruin it for me. You know, or they'll be like, that's exactly like the other song you wrote. Well, that's not good either.
Right.
So it's good to just, you know, not learn.
Right.
That's my excuse for not knowing my scales.
And you're sitting here with the guitar on your lap, but next to you here on the stage is this beautiful instrument. This is the autoharp. And in fact, the autoharp features on the title track, The Sea.
It does.
Tell us about that thing next to you then.
Well, I think this is another brilliant instrument for people who sing but don't play an instrument, because it's all in one sort of tone range. So is that on?
It is, yeah.
I'll
do you want me to hold that?
I might actually.
Oh, you've got your stand,
I've got
you?
My stand. So it's got lots of chords on here, and then you can just play any of these chords in any order, and anyone who is vaguely musical could just, you know, write them down like I do, because I haven't got a good memory. Yeah, if you were just to go down, it would sound like this. Which I love that sound. It's like a children's TV show and the magician comes in or something. But then these things kind of damp certain strings and let other strings ring on, so you'll get a definite... That's G major, apparently. And this is B flat 7. So, yeah, this is great, because you can just play any of these, yeah. Write them down.
And on the C, would you have written that on the guitar or on the auto?
No, I wrote this on the
you
auto
actually wrote it on the auto.
Yeah, because I like to use instruments that I'm not familiar with as well, because obviously I know my guitar, but I know these certain... You can sometimes fall into certain patterns. From my album that I'm writing now, I've written a few songs on piano. You know, I know nothing about the piano, but you can just sort of accidentally find things, and then certain chords will just spring me into
right.
a melody or something.
The interesting thing about the auto harp, I mean, it has almost a sea shanty-ish feel
yeah.
to it. And it made me think that on the PJ Harvey album, Let England Shake, she uses the same instrument.
She does.
And that album was recorded in Dorset, overlooking the sea. I don't know if there's a connection there. Where did you record the song, The Sea?
We actually recorded it near the sea. We recorded it in a residential studio in Scarborough. Because when I was recording The Sea, I just wanted us all to be like a little gang. I really wanted to be with my friends. And I invited Steve, who I played with
pianist
around the same
Steve
time.
Brown, who's
Steve
with us
Brown.
Today.
I also worked in this jazz club in the cloakroom and also on the bar. And Steve used to play there quite often. I met a lot of musicians at that time and wanted to work with them on the sea. Get that really sort of authentic, soulful, you know, I wanted the music to have movement in. A lot of my first album we had done to a click track, you know, so it's like all metronomically in time, and then we'd have the beats. We had no money, we couldn't pay any drummers. So with this album, I thought, wow, I'd really like to use a drummer. I'd really like to play and be able to say, right, this verse is slow, and then the chorus is faster, and then it all eases gently back in.
So the song The Sea, the title track, was one of the first songs written for the album, a song which imagines the loss of a loved one and the process of grief. But then, of course, you experienced that sense of loss yourself when your husband, Jason Ray, died in 2008. Tell us about Jason, first of all, because you mentioned working in that club. That's where you met him, didn't you?
Yeah, I met Jason in that club. I met him when I was in the cloakroom. And he sort of, like, walked past, and then he walked past again, and then he just sort of came and spoke to me and said hi to me. But he was a sort of presence, you know, and he was very charismatic and very persistent.
A musician.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a saxophone player. That night his band were playing, which I didn't realise, and then he invited me to come watch him play, and his band were called Taxi, and they were supporting Maceo Parker at this gig, and, you know, Maceo's this great horn player, used to play with James Brown.
J.B. Horns, yeah.
I was really excited to see the band, and I remember sort of walking in, you know, when you're 20, some of you are very, probably 20, you're probably younger than 20. I remember taking ages to get ready and then walking in and sort of seeing him on stage, and he was doing a solo, and it was just sort of building and building. I'd never seen him play, I'd never seen his band. And that's when my mind was sort of getting open to more sort of jazz and soul harmony, going away from the more simple indie stuff. So my mind was sort of blown musically by just the harmony and the rhythm, but then by him as well, I'm just been really blown away. And then it was weird, I sort of just knew at that point. So, yeah. But he was, you know, a really brilliant musician. And, yeah, so we got married in 2001. So we were married for 6.5 years, which is not a long time. But as I was saying about the past and future being at the same time, I think when you're married, you're always thinking about the future as well, and you're just imagining it goes on, and you're imagining having kids, and you're imagining growing old together. I mean, that's what you're sort of promising to do. Yeah, I remember working on this album, On the Sea, and I'd probably recorded about 7 or 8 of the tracks. And I was just really excited to sort of play it to him, but I was also, I feel like I'm out of breath speaking about it.
Take your time. Mm.
So, yeah.
You're already working on the album. And
I was already working about, yeah, a lot of it was done. And as I say, even I'd Do It All Again was already written and a lot of it was recorded. It's weird with the album because it sort of seemed like retrospectively people sort of perceived a lot of the songs to be about me losing Jace, but... Mm.
But a lot of them were about him when you were together. I mean, that song itself, I'll Do It All Again, is about the relationship. It's about you together, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah, and about just how hard marriages can be and you're in it together, but sometimes there's so much sort of struggle. It's just like, how are you going to make this work? And so that song I had written after one of those sort of conversations, I was already sort of playing my guitar when he came to speak to me. And then when he left, that song just kind of poured out, which was really... Again, sometimes it happens like that and sometimes it doesn't.
So that was a response to an argument, that song. I mean, it was a sort of a kind of cathartic.
Not so much an argument, but just like the impasse, which I think in a way it's worse than an argument because you feel like an argument might be have a resolve, but it's sort of like two people at loggerheads and no one really can sort of budge. But yeah, I think obviously when Jason died, it was so suddenly because it was this accident. It was so, so shocking, like impossible to describe when you just think your life's just going on in one direction and then it's like completely, completely changes.
But you must have, everything must have been put on hold after that. You've already got 6 or 7 songs on the go. So I presume at some point you must have thought, I can't go on. I can't do this. I mean, all bets were
off. Everything sort of completely stopped in my world. And... As I was saying about time again, time just turned into this, like, you know, when you see people making toffee and it just stretches out. It's just like that. So it just lasted. I can't think of how long it lasted, but there was a period of sort of nothing where I just saw a lot of my friends and a lot of my family and I was just in the house. Obviously, I wasn't writing and I wasn't hearing anything. I wasn't feeling anything. But then, yeah, I guess the weird thing with after this amount of time, there was just nothing. Then I just started to hear music again after not being able to hear it for a long time. So after that, I wrote I Would Like to Call It Beauty on the album, which came out of a conversation I'd had with my brother-in-law, Jason's younger brother, when I was asking him about, you know, what do you believe in and, you know, what do you think's true? And we talk about our sort of different beliefs. And he was saying that he thinks there's a sort of guiding thing in the universe or whatever, you know, that there's a force. And he said, I would like to call it beauty. Like he's got a Scottish accent. I think beauty controls the universe. It's a big thing to say. And so I wrote that song just about the intricacy and the beauty and the timing and the way people treat you, you know, who love you when you're just completely destroyed. You know, there is a massive level of beauty to it.
And I think what you achieve in that song, it's an astonishing song, and you sort of distill, I think, a sense of redemption and peace. There's a great sense of peace in that song. And almost, I don't know, maybe I've got this wrong, almost an acceptance of grief as a very powerful force that you have to accept in order to get through. That's what you're trying to deal with within
Definitely.
That song.
Definitely. I spoke to someone who described it as surrender, that you have to surrender to it. And then I remember being really sort of obsessed for months thinking, I don't know if I'm surrendering or not. You know, it's but then it really is like a completely passive process, I found. So a lot of people say, are you doing this? Are you doing that? Are you writing him letters? Are you thinking about him? Are you? And I remember just feeling, actually, at this point, I have nothing to do. My job is like to eat food. That's my only job. Eat food, sleep. So that was good to feel like this is this really passive. It's a ride and it's definitely happening. And after a long time, you'll accept, oh, I'm on this ride. I can't control it. This thing has happened that I can't control.
And you started this program this afternoon with the song that starts the album, Are You Here? That clearly is written in response to Jason's death. It's a tribute to him in a way. I mean, you say to us, the listener, you should see his eyes.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely song. It's a love song,
Thank you. Very heartfelt.
I presume when you could start writing again, when it started to come back, that was a cathartic feeling, was it, to pour it out
into the music? It definitely was. Part of the thing I was thinking about in that song was my sadness that I won't be able to introduce him to people.
He's a real live wire.
Yeah.
He's the best of his kind. Wait till you see his eyes. You get a sense of the man straight away.
Well, that's good. It's funny, I've always been one of those people who, you know, you have a party and you think, oh, you don't know if anyone's going to come or is everybody okay? Like, these people don't know these people. But Jace would always be like the sort of centre of the room. And I've seen it so many times. Maybe his back is to me, but I can see six, eight people that he's sort of regaling. Mm.
Very personal song, and there's an musically, there's an incredible moment that happens twice in that song where we almost get a sense of sensory overload, where you as the narrator of the song seem overwhelmed by the emotions, and that's evoked by the instruments coming together. The music rises, the singing becomes euphoric, and there's a reference to the tuberoses, the smell of tuberoses. Why that flower?
That came about because one of the first times I actually left the house on my own, which didn't happen for ages because I didn't want to be on my own, I thought that everyone was going to be asking me about it. And then it was weird to go out and realise no one was going to be asking me about it because the whole world had carried on turning, which I, you know, you don't realise is going to happen. It was raining loads, I hadn't taken my coat, torrential rain, and I went inside this florist to get out of the rain, and she had this massive bucket of what I now know to be tuberoses, but I didn't know what they were. And the shop was just sort of intensely thick with this scent, and sort of put my head in this bucket, and it was like intoxicating. And I was like, what are these flowers? And she said, oh, the tuberoses. And then I thought, that's it. That's what I want to be in my song, this idea of something that was really overwhelming and intense.
Intoxication, thought,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly, really, yeah, sort of being drunk with it, being finding it inescapable. And it was definitely sort of that type of a love. So I felt like the flowers would work. And we definitely went to town in the chorus on trying to find these layers. So there's like sleigh bells and then there's drums. And then we were doing something, was it called flanging or phasing?
Flanging.
It's called flanging. We're sort of running two versions of the drums at the same time, and they would sometimes get
slightly
a bit
out
of
sync
with each other.
And you get that flanged effect.
Yeah, so that's the thing that makes you feel like you're sort of you're drowning, and then there's like French horn, and then there's strings, and there's loads of vocal layers, and we wanted it to feel huge, you know.
And you talk about that sense of intoxication of almost being drunk on love, and your delivery, your vocal delivery as well. I mean, beautifully written words, but you kind of almost slur the words. I mean, they're not absolutely pronounced, and that's very important, I think, as well, isn't it? That you have to really throw yourself as a listener into the song in the way that you as the artist has thrown yourself into it.
I think so. It's so funny with words. I think words are really useful, but I think sometimes words really like get in the way. So I think I sometimes like to just take a word and just stretch it. The word itself has a meaning, but obviously the groan or sound that it's turned into has another meaning. Sometimes that's a deeper meaning than the word itself or whatever. So I really like to do that. Like with I Do It All Again, it's only recently that I realised the first line is just, oh, you know, just last that whole line. I like to do that because sometimes words aren't enough, you know, a musical version of a groan. I just can't help but respond to that.
Just being totally open, candid, letting it all flow. As an English literature graduate, of course, words are important to you. And I presume, therefore, are you here without the question mark at the end is significant. That's important because it's not really a question.
Yeah, it was really important for me not to have the question mark. I think partly because it just seemed with the question mark to be so sort of desperate, and I didn't want the song to just be desperate. So for me, it was a weird title because it was sort of like the words were moving around. So the sentence is also like, you are here. So it's like, are you here? You are here. You feel still such a connection to the person. I mean, I still feel that. So it's that thing of the past and the present, the future all being conflated.
And the song's totally written in the present tense as well.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was another interesting thing about it. For ages, I couldn't speak in the past tense. Mm. So I couldn't say, like, he was. Or I just could not say that for years. It just didn't make any grammatical sense to me. So I guess it took a long time for my brain to catch up with that.
Well, that's all we've time for in this first part of the programme. There's a lot more to discuss about Corinne's remarkable album, The Sea, and its legacy. So we'll be continuing this discussion in the second part of this edition of Master Tapes, the B-side, where our studio audience get to pose the questions. But for now, Corinne Bailey-Ray, thank you very much indeed.
And as Corinne gets ready to play us out, a reminder about the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can hear all of the programmes in the series and exclusive live versions and videos of some of the songs we've discussed, including this one by Corinne Bailey-Ray, The Sea.
I never knew you were standing on the shore, says everything. Explains everything. And from then on, couldn't be just like before. Same as everything. Changes everything. So don't you stand there wishing.
I didn't want to be a DJ. I got offered the gig at a Roxy by default. Punk came along and created a musical ground zero. Andrew opened the punk rock club and there wasn't a DJ. And I'd been playing music in the shop, getting a great response to that. And he said, Don, have a go at DJing. And I thought, hey, why not?
This is Don Letts.
I mean, it's how I live. I mean, I listen to music 24/7. I go to bed with the radio on. Culture Clash Radio reflects my musical journey, which started way back when and ends, well, it doesn't. And that's the point. Another thing that I do is I try to embrace the new, because I think we're duty bound to shine a light on stuff that might otherwise slip under the radar. You know, it's all got a place in my world.
Don Letts, Culture Clash Radio.
Sunday nights from...